Welcome to the Autism Mom MD podcast, where we discuss empowerment, growth, and inclusion for individuals with autism. And now your host, Dr. Carol Baltazar.
Hi, everyone. This is Dr. B. Welcome to the Autism Mom MD podcast. First, I want to quickly remind everybody that my podcast is intended for educational purposes only and is not medical advice. Please talk to your doctor if you have questions. The views and opinions expressed by me and my guests are our own personal opinions. Today's episode highlights adulting on the spectrum. My guest today is Samuel Huber. Sam is an autism self-advocate and public speaker. He provides an autistic perspective on various topics relating to adulthood on his YouTube channel and Instagram. Please join me in welcoming Sam Huber. Hi, Sam.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm doing wonderful in this beautiful 70 degree weather. Yeah.
I know. It's great, right?
Yeah, so great.
I think you're just north of me. I'm in Maryland. Where are you at?
I'm working in Philadelphia, but I live in King of Prussia.
Oh, okay. Okay. So can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your family?
Sure. I'm 31 years old. I live in King of Prussia with my wife, Gisette, and my son, Sky, who's 3 years old. I was diagnosed with autism at age 14, and I was lucky to have a mom who was in the field. So she was like basically my life coach for a lot of years. But then as an adult, I took a lot of psych courses in college to understand how people work in a logical way. Mm-hmm. And then for the last 9 years, I've worked in the autism field myself to not only help individuals like me, but also help better understand myself in so many unique ways.
Oh, well, then I wanted to ask you, what was it like before your autism diagnosis? Did you feel like you were different from your peers at school?
I would say, definitely. Because I noticed my brain thought differently. I didn't communicate the same way they did. I couldn't pay attention as long as they did. I got held back. I did the first grade twice, so didn't feel as intelligent rather than realizing that, my autism, made it really hard for me to read. And, I couldn't learn the normal way. I had to find my own way of learning to read. It's the best word I'm sure a lot of your guests have used is I felt different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's what my son would say too. He was diagnosed earlier than you, but we actually didn't tell him till a little bit later. Did you learn about it right when your parents got the diagnosis? I mean, did they tell you right away?
Yeah, because, my mom in the field, I got first diagnosed when I was in the first grade with ADHD and nonverbal learning disability, which means I couldn't read body language. Mm. And she always felt, that's wrong. She's a therapist, so I have a lot of clients who are so much like my son. So after going through many different schools, my mom was just like, no, I've had it. Let's get the diagnosis. Let's figure out if I'm right. And she was. And part of the huge thing is, she didn't feel the need to hide it. I've asked her years later, because what would happen is I would think there'd be something wrong with being autistic if she decided to hide it. Cause I'm consciously aware I'm being tested for something here, mm-hmm. especially at age 14, like a 2-year-old may not be aware of that. But for me at age 14, I'm like, something's going on here. They're asking me some weird questions. So at that point, is at that age where I'm starting to question everything. Mm-hmm. I remember asking her straight up, what's going on here? And she told me what it was. And then she explained how my brain worked, at least to the best of her ability. And then, but I would say the biggest feature of how my autism works is this life experience. They threw me into a lot of life experiences. I never had an IEP. I had no, what the kids have today. Like I was still like the age where the 90s, where they just shoved, Ritalin down our throats and like, okay, they're good now for a while. So it was a lot of just like self-discovery. And that was my ultimate therapy. And then in middle school, that's when I started going to a school specializing for children with learning differences and started being around peers like me. And I said, there are others like me. Oh. Mm-hmm. But then, I went to college around a lot of neurotypicals, which is, where I learned even more social. Like, I knew how to socialize with Aspies, but I didn't had no idea how to socialize with neurotypical children, because my high school was like this old 18th century mansion up on a hill, like in the woods, like, you know, this private school that we didn't interact with the rest of the world. And so it was a big, like, a culture shock for me to be around a bunch of neurotypicals, especially, you know, like, there was no girls in my school. Well, one girl in my high school, but she, like, hid from everyone because she was the only girl. As I'm sure any woman would, because as you know, being in the field, the ratio in autism is 4 to 1.
Mm-hmm.
Especially back then, like, women were not being diagnosed. And I found through my own podcast, so many women don't get diagnosed with their autism until their 20s, which is a crime. Anyway, I was around women. I was around neurotypical men my own age. And the most healing thing was realizing that no one in college knows who the hell they are.
Mm-hmm.
That like, it brought me out of my shell, that, like, they would just hide out with the rest of the known Aspies on campus for 2 years. I'm like, I want a small dose of what Animal House was. This Animal House, that movie, was my only idea of what college was.
Well, when you first got the diagnosis, when your parents got the diagnosis, were you diagnosed with Asperger's? I mean, now it's classified under autism spectrum disorder, but so.
I got diagnosed with Asperger's, but now I identify as high functioning autistic.
Mm-hmm. Did you find, like, when you were younger, like in elementary, middle school, then was it kind of difficult, like with socialization skills? And
it was very hard, because I would try, like, everything, and then looking back, I'd be like a bit too much, like I wouldn't stop talking, like not let that person like edge in to the conversation, and I would overwhelm other children, so they would, you know, bully me or push me away, and I had to deal with a lot of bullying, so that started making me isolate myself until about sophomore year in high school, when I started noticing other children with similar interests, and that's how I started connecting with other children. Was, oh, you like Metallica? I like Metallica. And it was through making that visual connection with another peer, I started having the normal teenage experiences. And again, the gift my parents gave me was, as long as they knew where I was, they let me just be a normal teenager. Because even though I have autism, they're like, it should not exclude him from life. Let him go get into trouble.
Right.
Not too much trouble, right. but just, you know,
be a kid.
Be a kid. And I know for a lot of my clients, I'm sure yours and your son too, like, they felt excluded for so long, but here I was my sophomore year in high school, and I'm like, I'm getting invited to hang out with people. I'm getting invited. And then I started, you know, watching my new friends and learning their cultural habits, which surrounded music. Like, the one thing I understood, and we spent hours just talking about music, and that's where my social skills started to develop. Because that's once that special interest has been connected between two people, Aspie or not, like, it's how we learn to bond, and through trial and error, that's still my biggest teacher. Like, I got punched in the face for being too annoying sometimes, but like, I learned not to be that way anymore.
Well, Sam, just to kind of like go back a little bit more also, when you say you were diagnosed with Asperger's, and some of our listeners might just be starting their journey, what are some of the characteristics that you have?
Well, the big one everyone talks about is trouble making eye contact. I had a light sensitivity sensory wise. I used to be a very black and white thinker before I went through a lot of therapy. Like, either it was this or that. There's no in between. And then when someone taught me a social rule, I believe it to be like actual physical law, that if I did not abide by this law, I would, you know, the person would hate me. And then I would obsess over that miscue. And like, it would be like days, weeks later, I'm still thinking about that miscue. The other part is thinking, abstractly, like things like God or math, I couldn't wrap my head around. I had to know why we're learning algebra. I'm like, where in the real world will I need those? And the teacher would be like, well, Sam, if you become an architect, you would need them. Like, I have no interest. And I just get wrapped up in that detail of the why.
Mm-hmm.
And for someone with Asperger's, I think that's the biggest like telling sign is getting lost in details that seem random to another person. But it's like, once we have all the pieces to the puzzle, then like we can socialize. But when we see something missing, it's like we fixate on it. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes us such great inventors and thinkers, is we see what's missing. Another huge example was in church. As a kid, I went to a Quaker meeting house, and the Sunday school teacher would start reading like stories like Noah's Ark, and I would start asking question after question, not realizing that she was trying to teach, and I was overstepping my question. You know, it was like she would never get through a lesson because I was like, "But how did Noah feed the animals?" And she couldn't. Where, if like, you know, they couldn't venture out and hunt for meat, did they feed the other animals to the meat eaters? And it would just go on, and then to the point where she got so fed up that she kicked me out of Sunday school. And it's being met with like, he's asking like all these difficult questions that I don't have time or don't have the answer to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, and then a lot of introspective, like I couldn't, when I was younger, I couldn't speak above like a one syllable word. I couldn't say words like remember or hospital. Like I had to, you know, go through speech therapy, and that in a nutshell is my Asperger's. It's just like constantly questioning reality, a lot of social anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Cause like, it's cause I want to connect with people, but I get so caught up in the details of their face, or cause the way I was taught to socialize is read their face, but I spend more time doing that than listening to them. And that would cause a lot of my social issues. It was like, Sam, I was talking to you. I'm like, sorry, I got distracted by your nose ring for the last 5 minutes. or something small like that. And it's just this constant need to ground myself and through my, you know, years of taking psychology class, I learned how to, as like a therapist, read people and then actively listen. It taught me this scientific grounded way of communicating with somebody, which I recommend for any Aspie in college. Take some psych courses. Like that can teach you so much about how to read people in a scientific and logical way.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned that you had trouble making eye contact. You know, my son initially, so he was diagnosed with Asperger's too when he was younger, and he did have trouble making eye contact for a while. I'm just kind of curious, what were some strategies that you use to help maintain eye contact when you're talking to somebody?
First, I remind myself that I don't have to maintain it the whole conversation, because A, that's creepy. If someone just like staring so intently into your eyes.
Yeah.
Which leads me to my second strategy. I count to three once I leave someone's eyes. 1, 2, 3, back to their eyes. Is a huge help, because it relieves my anxiety, and it allows me to actually listen to the person. Because if I'm just focus on making eye contact with you, it's like two different functions in my brain. Either I can listen to you, or I can make eye contact. You as the person that's talking, which would you prefer? I actually heard you, or I, you know, held your eye contact. Like you have something I do with my wife all the time. Like when I first started dating her, she's like, "You're not making eye contact." I'm like, "Well, you know, me as your boyfriend, would you rather me hear what you actually said, or miss your point entirely and piss you off?" I pick up vibrations in the air better, and that's how I actually learned to listen. And it's like it's my own thing. And eye contact's not that important to me, but I know it is to other people. So I have this 3-second rule of, all right, come back to the eyes, because I know it's important to them that I make at least some eye contact.
Yeah. I remember when my son was like in elementary school, one of the teachers, she actually sent a letter home saying that, oh, maybe your son needs to get his eyes checked because he's not making eye contact. And I'm like, he has it's not his like it's not like he needs a prescription. It's, you know, it's part of his, you know, autism. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's who he is. So mm-hmm. what we tried to do was tell him to when he's talking to somebody, like look between their eyes. And then that seemed to help. But it's interesting, like the perspective on like some people, it is important to maintain eye contact, I think, but you know, it's like, there's some certain things that you just have to accept about somebody. Like we can't just fix somebody and just say, okay, here's, you need to go get your eyes checked and get a prescription mm-hmm. for glasses. And that would fix your eye contact, you know?
Right. Yeah. It's definitely a different perspective. And the other big part that helped me with the whole getting over the need to make eye contact was in sociology, in different cultures, where you look is not eye contact. Like certain Middle Eastern cultures, if you're talking to an elder, especially, you're supposed to look at the ground,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
you know, out of sign of respect. If you look them in the eye, that's disrespectful.
Mm-hmm.
And across the board, like each culture has a different perspective of where your eye should be in a conversation. Some like should be looking at the mouth or the forehead, and after that, I just like, why am I wasting my time trying to, like, you know, blare a hole in the back of someone's head by making eye contact? I'd rather actually listen to them and actually have a conversation, rather than getting lost in trying to fit this idea that normal people make eye contact throughout a whole conversation.
Well, I wanted to also ask you, how did you, you know, with, you said you did speech therapy, but really, how did you get really comfortable with public speaking?
The way I got, I guess it started with me being a teacher's assistant. I had to teach children.
Hmm.
So I just stand in front of a room, talk to them. And, you know, children are people. So talking to adults, it, to me, is no different.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the fact that I discovered that I like to run my mouth when it comes to talking about autism. So I'm never, when I'm public speaking, I know a lot of people's anxiety is like connecting with the audience, but usually I'm looking all around the room. But I have my 3 second rule. Okay. 1, 2, 3, back to the audience. And also I allow myself to stim in front of my audience, which is conducting my wife calls my conducting, where I wave my hands back and forth, which allows me to concentrate on what I have to say and what to say next.
Ah, okay.
It's kind of like I'm feeling out the room. And I can, while I'm moving my hands, it helps me feel up the vibe. Like, okay, am I ranting on too long? Should I, you know, what do these people need to hear? And it's just like, one thing I love about being autistic is we have to move our body in order to express ourselves and communicate. So like that's how I came comfortable. I just had to be myself in front of an audience, because people want to know what it's like to be autistic as an adult. I have to be the example. I have to show them.
Mm-hmm.
And they came here to see me, so that makes me feel good about myself, rather than me coming to them, which for autistic people, like, that's the anxiety. Oh, we have to go to you to socialize. No, these people came to me.
Mm-hmm.
They want to hear, and I remind myself, they want to hear what I have to say. So it gives me a bit of an ego and confidence.
Did you have like difficulties with social cues when you were younger?
Oh, what social cue didn't I have trouble with? I had, like I said, I had trouble like letting another person into the conversation. Like understanding why they did what they did, like through their behaviors. Like I said, I couldn't read body language until I took psych classes in college, where, like, you know, the class broke down everyone's body language to open stance, closed stance, and what that means.
Okay.
The other big thing is being able to tell if a girl, since we're talking about adulting, if a girl actually likes me, or is it just in my head? Because, like, when I was younger, like, oh, she's pretty. We had a 5 minute conversation. She must like me. No, maybe she's just being. It's how to. I learned, like, if girl like twirls her fingers in her hair, and, you know, and she's smiling. I mean, I had to learn that is when a girl's into you. But if her arms are crossed and her body's turned away from me, that means she's turned off. And I had to learn to ultimately make my autism like a pickup line. Like, it makes me, you know, very eccentric and. And I had to tighten my strength, and that's what made me sexy. Not, I used to use like pickup lines. I took like lines from James Bond, like, and I tried them out on women, and it never worked. And it took me years to realize, oh, it's not what he's saying. Cause they're, if you look at the actual lines, they're terrible, but it's the fact that he's so, so confident.
Yes.
That's what gets women drooling over him. And I had to learn to be confident, even if I didn't actually feel confident inside. And then other cues were like, you know, most recently with coworkers, like learning to communicate how my autism affects me. Because I said, I'm a visual learner on the first day I met them. I said, oh, they're in the autism field. They know what that means, that I have horrible auditory processing skills. They did. And I had to, like, so I had a bit of, you know, misunderstandings with them until I spelled it out for them, that this is how I process information. This is how you need to communicate with me. I had to, you know, be my advocate at work. And so there isn't one miscue I haven't gone through, but I keep a journal of those, and I talk with my therapist about them. To answer your question, yeah, like there are tons of miscues. I've hit them all when it comes to the ones that autistic people usually miss. Especially when people are being passive aggressive. One of the things I love about my wife is she is very, very blunt. Like, I know what she's saying is what she means, rather than, okay, she says she's fine, but does it actually mean she's fine? if I piss her off, like, she'll use some very choice words. And I pissed her off. That leads to me needing to advocate, like, I need you to be blunt with me. Like, I know that it's hard for you to be honest about what you want from your partner, but like, that's actually, I think something sexy about dating someone on the spectrum is like, they force you to get right to the nitty gritty. Like, I want a man or a woman that does X, Y, and Z. Can you meet that? And that's why my wife got married after only dating for a year, while we had a kid after only being together two years. It just like it gets being autistic makes you as an adult get down to the nitty gritty of adult relationships. And if you realize how powerful this is, like, people go years without actually connecting with somebody. But with autistic people, you as the neurotypical person have to put in the effort, or you're never going to actually connect with us if you want to.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever feel like you had to reach certain milestones or accomplish and experience certain things by a certain time?
Oh yeah. Like I went through the whole thing, like Sam's missing the marker of where he should be developmentally. I was in the doctors and the therapist's office when I'm growing up, like, he's missing his markers. Teachers are like, most of my students by this age, should have hit this. And as an adult, I've had to get to the point where like, oh, I should have my driver's license by now. I'm 31 years old. I still don't have my driver's license. I should have a high paying job by now, but the new philosophy I have is I'm on Hawaiian time. I get there when I get there. And that makes me forget about the milestones rather than just, and it allows me to meet myself where I'm at.
Right. I totally agree with you. I mean, you mentioned driving, and that was like a big thing for my son. So like, when he was in high school, he did learn how to drive while he was in high school. But, the thing was that I had him do, the driver's ed twice. Once, it's not like he failed driver's ed or anything, or driver's training, but I had him do it twice just because I wanted to make sure he got all the information. And then I also had him, because we're in Maryland, I had him also do a course on inclement weather. So I, you know, like over here, like the like police training grounds, like, you know, they can take the students out and like, you know, they go over like what to do when it's icy. So anyway, he just felt like, oh my gosh, you know, it's like, there's so many steps for me to get my license. Whereas everybody else, for him, he felt like, oh, they just got their license right away. So it was kind of, that was like a big thing for him. He just was like, you know, like, why am I not, accomplishing this goal, like right when I'm, you know, whatever, mm-hmm. Why can't I get my permit right when I'm 15, you know, exactly 15, you know, mm-hmm. or why can't I get my license exactly when I'm 16? I'm like, well, everybody goes at their own pace, you know, and, mm-hmm. and, you clearly, you know, you said that so well about, you know, you're on Hawaii time. So.
Yeah. And the other thing I also point out to my clients, especially the older ones, is in autistic schools, they're taught how to read people emotionally and a lot about psychology. And in neurotypical schools, they're not taught that. So you're look at where you're ahead in certain areas and like how much your autism is a blessing because you're learning how to, you know, really understand people on a deep level. And that's something a lot of our youngsters aren't getting today. So like, while you may be high in some areas, you're way ahead in others. That's what I try to focus on. Mm-hmm. Where am I ahead of other 31-year-olds? Oh, I'm way more emotionally attention than the stereotypical man is at my age. And that's a blessing. And that's what I tell my clients. Where are you ahead? Stop looking at what autism takes away from you or look at rather what it has given you.
Right, right. Well, you provide the autistic perspective on topics relating to adulthood on your YouTube channel, as well as on Instagram. Mm. Sam, what does adulting mean to you?
Adulting means to me finding a way to live out your dreams and finding your own way. Adulting means to me that if you want to have a family, you can have a family. If you don't ever want to have a family, that you just want to have a boyfriend or girlfriend, that's fine. It's about finding your purpose in life, whatever that might be. It's not what society tells you should be. Because I went through my whole life being told what I should be. And that caused me a lot of distress, depression, and a lot of negative ways of thinking. But once I tried to forget about all that and actually try to be an adult, I realized that adulting is I can grow at my own pace. I can
Sam, hold on a sec. I just lost you. I can't hear you. You're okay. Can you try talking again?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, now I can hear you. Uh-huh.
I was saying that adulting for me is the constant reminder that I'm in control, that I can show people how to react to my autism, how to react to me. I can't control how they react, but I can, I can be my own person and choose who I hang out with. And the big thing I learned throughout college was if my autism doesn't bother me, it won't bother other people. And it's just going through the day to day. That's what adulting is. And there's not someone hovering over your shoulder prompting you, oh boy. And that's really what it comes down to adulting for me. Is
Sorry,
go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead. I didn't want to cut you off.
Yeah, it's what my parents taught me from day one of me knowing I was autistic, that the best teacher in life is trial and error. And that's the only way any of us learn as an adult.
Right. Well, this is like a good segue on a few things I'd like to ask you about. You mentioned college. And so I'd like your perspective on some adulting topics. How did you navigate college?
Well, number one, I went down to the disabilities office and I got a letter of recommendation, which for listeners who don't know what that is, it basically it's like a list of the things you need to succeed in the college classroom. And the other key thing is I met with each of my professors so that I made sure that they understood what the letter meant. Cause a lot of professors, you know, aren't trained what, you know, how the autistic mind works. And that's the hugest thing. And you don't, my mom said, you don't have to be an expert on what autism is, just how it affects you. The other huge thing that I learned to navigate is, like I said, in my third year, I'm like, I'm tired of sitting just in my PJs watching the same movies over and over again, with the ASPE club at my college. I wanted to have the real college experience. So, I went out and joined a bunch of social clubs with that pertaining to my personal interests, like art, music, and a couple other things. So I met a lot of neurotypical people that had similar interests. And through trial and error, I made friends. Like one friend, you know, I forgot to text him that I wanted to hang out and didn't realize it was 3 in the morning. So I'm banging on his door, and he opens the door, and I come bursting in, like, all right, let's hang out. And he's like, Sam, it's 3 a.m. And he grabbed me by the scruff of my shirt and literally threw me out of his dorm room. and he said, and he screamed at me for, like, text before you, you know, make sure I'm still awake before you try to hang out with me, because that was such a night out. And it's through, you know, even though that sounds scary to some people, it taught me, you know, the importance of advocating and messaging friends. The other huge thing that is, I started going to college parties before I was 21. So there was a lot of alcohol around. And my dad gave me a trick, like, you don't have to drink if you're not comfortable. Just go to the trash when no one's looking, grab 3 or 4 cans, or empty it out in your beer in the bathroom. And like, I drank this many. just like little tricks. So it made me feel included. Mm-hmm. I'm not encouraging anyone to underage drink, but like, you want to feel included. You don't want to feel like, oh, I'm the only one here not drinking. So like little things like that. And the other big part is like, just recognize when people are comfortable with you or not. Like, and that's okay. And just focus on the people that are excited to see you.
Right. Did you use like note-taking services or, you know, any like assistive devices or, you know, to help with your studies?
I had a note-taker because just like eye contact, note-taking and listening to a professor are two different wavelengths. I can mm-hmm. do one or the other. I can't do both. Mm-hmm. So I would get stuck like writing the first note and he'd be like 20 minutes into the lecture. So in my letter of recommendation, I had a note taker who would submit anonymously to the disabilities office. They didn't know who they were writing notes for, but they got like a little extra credit. And I would just, you know, read their notes, and that was my note taking, how I took notes. And then I would copy their notes, like handwrite them over and over so I could learn the information. And also utilizing office hours. I can't emphasize that enough. Your professors are there to talk to you, like, go talk to them if you don't understand what they just taught.
Yes, I could totally vouch for that. I had a discussion with my son just over the weekend about, you know, a quiz that he took. And, you know, I was like, so did you understand like the questions you got wrong? And he's like, well, I made an appointment to meet with my professor to go over those questions. And yeah, exactly mm-hmm. what you're talking about. I mean, I think mm-hmm. it's really important. And part of it too is as far as like his, how Asperger's manifests in him, part of it is like the language skills, like just being able to infer things. Inferences were always difficult for him. So sometimes mm-hmm. like word problems that could be challenging on a test mm-hmm. to figure out what is the professor actually asking in this mm-hmm. question, you know?
I had someone actually sit with me and explain what the professor, it was in my letter that someone sits with me and explains this is what they're asking, like, especially for essay questions where I would like would list off every fact I know about the question without actually answering it correctly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So like having like, so in my letter, I had double the time it took to take an exam so that someone could sit with me and either I could dictate the answer to them or they can look at my answer and cut it down to what the professor is actually saying. Mm-hmm. And also having a quiet space, like, cause I hearing all those pencils like scraping against paper, like, is so distracting for me. That's not a huge part of my test taking. And
Right. Right. As I know, like some schools now, some colleges that, you know, you can go take a, cause we looked at different colleges before my son ultimately chose the one he's going to now. But when you go take your test, you can go to a different center that's separate. So that's like much more quiet. But you mentioned the other thing too, about like, you know, you were talking about, dictation. And, you know, it's interesting mm-hmm. now, things have, you know, technology has come a long way. I mean, there are like recorders, like my son uses this program and it's called Sonocent. And I'm not sure if you've heard of it, but basically it's an app on his phone and he turns it on, you know, while the professor is giving the lecture. And it just, when he gets back to his room, so it records it in class, gets back to his room, uploads it, and it transcribes everything.
That's amazing. Like, it makes me think of Dragon Speak. That was like my version of that back in the day. But
yeah, Dragon was always like had some flaws though.
So yeah, it did. So I went old school and just had someone submit their notes into the office.
But yeah, so I think it is important to like advocate for yourself, definitely in college. And you know, but it's a great time to like practice those adulting skills and becoming more independent. So when you were in college, did you get an internship, or did you do any of that or did you work while you were in college?
No, I didn't work because my parents were, I think, just so excited that I had friends that like they were like, no, just, you know, go have fun. It wasn't until after I graduated college, I got my first real job at the school that my mom worked for as a teacher's assistant. So they also just wanted me to focus on my grades because they knew it took me extra time to complete assignments. Mm-hmm. So like their attitude was kind of like, what time does he have to work?
And they also
wanted me to find who I was, because like my dad, for example, it took him 10 years to finish college, but he found his passion, which is writing. And he wanted me to have that same opportunity. And my mom worked all the time in college. She's like, just to pay for her college. And so she's like, I don't want that for him. I want him to enjoy experience, because you only go to college once. And you're only young once. Like, what, you know, he's all the rest of his life to work.
Right. It sounds like you've got great parents.
Thank you.
So I wanted to ask you, what was your major in college?
It was psychology until my last semester of my senior year, when I kept failing my math course. I just, the professor wasn't willing to meet my accommodations for whatever reason. He just has an attitude like, if, you know, he studies hard enough, he should be able to get, you know, a passing grade. And I failed his class twice. So I switched to family studies, which is a mix between psychology and sociology. So I graduated on time. And that individualized major did not require a math credit. And that's the other huge thing I tell my clients who have gone to college, like, look for things that majors that play to your strength. Don't force yourself into something that you're going to really struggle with. And it's like, there are ways around it. Like, I didn't have to take a language course. I never took Spanish or anything in high school. Mm-hmm. I just took like world culture, and that counted as my language credit. So like, there are creative ways around. If you are on the spectrum, you have some sort of language barrier.
Right. No, my son had that too. So,
and that's a huge thing I would say to any of your listeners, like, you know, find your own route to get to the masters that or bachelors that you want. There's so many alternatives.
Right. And speaking about the foreign language requirement, actually, some schools will let you do sign language as your foreign language.
That's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sign language actually is perfect for autistic people, because it's a visual language.
Yeah.
Because my big thing when I try to learn other languages is I get caught up in the pronunciation so much that like I never really learned anything, but like teaching my clients sign language has really allowed me to I actually can learn. I actually do remember how the simple phrases, and it's an excellent universal language, because like everyone in the world has some version of it.
Mm-hmm. What about some advice for like those trying to enter the workforce, you know, in terms of trying to look for a job? Was it pretty challenging for you and to find a job? And the other thing is, so like I said, is like, what advice would you give to others who are looking?
Yeah. So the way it happened after I graduated, my mom did not give me a job at her school right away, because she wanted me to see how hard the job market is. So I went on a bunch of interviews. And it was really hard because my people skills at that time were not that great. Like I didn't realize that until You know, I got my experience as a job coach at my mom's school, where the way we taught our autistic kids how to prepare for interviews is videotape themselves practicing so they can see their body language. Mm-hmm. Like, I had no idea how much I picked at my face when someone's interviewing me. So, like, I interviewed myself and, like, videotaped myself. And, like, I saw how poor my body language. So I worked on sitting up straight, having a inviting open stance rather than, you know, having my arms crossed. And then also practice the questions over and over and, like, learn everything there is about the job. Like, that's my strength, is like, I can learn, if I'm into something, I can learn every little fact and detail about it. Mm-hmm. And so turning that autistic superpower into an interviewing skill is extremely helpful. And the other part is, if you just want to get some job experience, I would recommend actually becoming a teacher assistant in the autism field, because your biggest pickup line during the interview is, I'm autistic, I know what these kids have gone through. So, like, that can be just a start of getting some sort of job experience. The other big part is, look for jobs that, if you are a visual learner, require a lot of visual thinking. If you don't have good auditory processing skills, don't do something that requires a lot of auditory processing. The other big part is, don't stop advocating for yourself. That's the hugest part. And I'm still learning that with every new job I get, that I have, you know, no one knows how autism affects me but me. I have to spell it out for people and be comfortable doing that. Mm-hmm. Once I had the job, because the biggest thing I've learned and why autistic adults don't finish college or don't keep a job is not the job itself. It's the social aspect, not being, you know, comfortable with expressing how they see the world. And so I would spend a lot of time learning to love your autism and love yourself, and learning how to positively express yourself to your employer or potential future employer, so that when they learn you're on the spectrum, it's like, oh, it does not bother Sam at all, so I should still hire him. But if you're like, it has really hurt my life, it's made life so hard, they're gonna be like, oh, this is gonna be a difficult employee, I don't know if I'll give this person a chance. It's your attitude about your autism and yourself that really sells you in an interview. The other part I would highly recommend is, iron out your clothes and hang them the night before. Don't try them, like, be fully prepared the night before, so you're not rushing in the morning, because that would get me so hyper when I try to get my clothes and all my notes and everything together in the morning. Mm-hmm. And then I would get anxious, and then I was so anxious I would forget my brilliant responses to questions, and I would screw up interviews. Be ready to go the night before is a huge thing, with everything you're bringing. You know, choose your outfit. So, like, all you have to think about is your answers and and how you're going to present yourself the day of the interview.
So did you disclose to, when you went on your interviews to the employers, that you have autism, or what do you think about that?
Every job I've had has been in the autism field. So yes, because, like I said, it's my biggest selling point. That I know what your clients have gone through, because I've been mm-hmm. there.
Right.
And that's why I sometimes just, maybe you should go into the field that you know yourself, because it gets you that job experience. But if I have tried to go after jobs that aren't in my field, like, if I think somehow it'll benefit. Again, if I am so calm about my autism, I think you should disclose it. Like, it's only when you're freaking out, it gives them a reason to freak out. If they have questions about, you know, like, have it lined up. Okay, yes, I have autism, but this is why it makes me a great employee. It makes me see things that no one else sees. It makes makes me a great visual learner. It gives me great attention to detail. Like, figure out what strengths your autism gives you. And then when you bring it up in the interview, that's what you tell them about. Like, I have autism, and this is why it's amazing that I do. Boom, 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 boom. Mm-hmm. You know, and that, the employers will be impressed with that.
Right.
And I've had many adult clients get jobs because they did that. They're like, it's not a disability. This is how we end the stigma in the workforce, is because we're like, boom, boom, this is why I'm awesome, because I have autism.
Well, you mentioned, I'm sorry, Sam, but you mentioned the clients. Now you have adult clients. What exactly are you doing? Is this part of like your position as being a TA or?
Well, I was a job coach at my previous job. So 18 to 21 year olds, and I've done some mentoring on the side with adults, and then people at conferences come up to me all the time asking me the same questions you're asking me. Right now I work with early intervention, so kiddos that just got diagnosed, but I've worked with people of all ages on the spectrum throughout my 9 years as a professional. But working with adults gave me the passion to advocate for people like me and to do what I'm doing on my YouTube and my Instagram, because I'm like I'm being so, I've met so many people that are get late diagnoses and are like, okay, now what? And I'm like, well, let's make autism sexy. Cause you know, in our American culture, especially, that sexy sells. We're trying to get a friend, love interest or a job, like let's give you that James Bond kind of confidence about yourself on who you are, rather than, you know, your autism takes away some of you, like you're different, not less, as right. Temple Grandin always likes to say.
Right. I mean, it really sounds like you're, you know, a very focused person and you've got a lot of strategies and tools to help you succeed in life. But with all that focus, have you ever like experienced burnout or felt like you were like close to it?
I experience burnout all the time. I actually just came out of a burnout situation. What causes my autistic burnouts is I spend too much time trying to read someone's cues, and then I obsess over like, oh my God, I missed it. I missed that one and that one. Okay, what does their tone mean? At the same time, remembering all the chores I have to do at home, all the things I have to do, like remembering all the things I have to do, and also trying to process my emotions, like just trying to remember all the things. It's the big thing about autistic people is everything we process through our sensory input, everything we process through our conscious and subconscious, it's all conscious. There's no subconscious in how we process the world. So that causes me to burn out all the time. But and I used to always say my brain is broken, you know, when that would happen. I was like, no, it's not broken. It just needs to be nutrients. It means I have to feed, I have to eat the right foods or take the right supplements to recharge the brain, which would be, you know, like what my brain needs, like things that are very grounded, like mushroom tea, protein, you know, gene, brain power, omega 3s has been big for me lately. The other big part is I have to look at my burnouts as a chance to love myself and be kind. But yeah, I go through, when I get burned out, I go through 3 or 4 days of feeling like, you know, the crap's been beat out of me. I can't string two sentences together. I'm like just off in the outer space. So I still experience it, but the way I get out of it is I reclaim the focus that you were just talking about. And you know, the big thing that's helped me, especially with us here, is religion, reading my Bible, returning to my special interest helps me climb out of that burnout. And that's the way I think a lot of people should try to climb out of it, is rather than, oh, I'm broken. You're not broken. This is temporary. But you've burnt out before and haven't you come back? And sometimes you just you need that reminder of like, oh yeah, I burned out before, but I got my energy back. I got my ability to process thoughts back. Like the constant, what I have to remind myself is this is temporary. And just be kind.
Yeah. And like the stuff that we were talking about, what could lead to burnout and all that focus. I think that's like a term that a lot of people use is masking. Would you say that for you, is that masking? What do you think about masking?
Actually, it's the topic I've been thinking about a lot. Masking, I think, is the number one cause of autistic burnout, because it's not our, what I like to say, it's not our natural language. It's like, you know, Spanish is my mother-in-law's first language and English is her second. I can tell when she speaks in English for long periods of time, it wears her out. But when she's talking in her first language, which is Spanish, she can go da-da-da-da-da for hours and hours and not wear herself out. Because you, for autistic people, masking is like remembering your second language. Okay, in English, it means it this way. In Spanish, it means it that way. It's the same thing with, okay, for autistic person, our facial language is our hands, the way we stim. For example, the higher my hand goes on my body as I'm stimming, like going up, 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 the more excited I am or the more anxious I am. Because if I'm touching my face a lot, like this, that is will indicate my wife has picked up, Sam's really anxious, and she'll turn to me, Sam, what's going on here? But if she sees my hand conducting like this, oh, Sam's excited. You know, what are you excited about? And she takes that cue. But for me, it's exhausting because I'm, when it comes to masking, because I'm like, I'm trying to read all the minutiae. Like, what does that tone of voice mean? Was that, okay, she lifted her eyebrows. Is this person mad at me? And it's all the stuff that neurotypical people do subconsciously. Like, they pick up on the tone of voice. Okay, it's fight or flight right here. And they know how they instinctually respond. No, I have to consciously think about all that stuff. And it burns me out. And I had the recent realization that I should try to communicate no matter who that, the autistic way. Like I said, forget about eye contact because that's going to just wear me out. Rather, I'm going to focus on what I actually want to do, which is listen to the person, because that's way, I prioritize, that's way more important. And also, there's no concept of normal. Like how I talked about earlier in college, no, even the neurotypical kids did not know who the heck they were. And once I made that realization, I stopped masking around them. I started openly stimming. And the other,
okay.
And then at work, I know there's a time, I tell my clients when they go to work, there's a time and place to stim. Like I go into the bathroom and conduct, or when I'm at my desk, I'll have sensory toys or I'll let my fingers move. And it's when I try to suppress that and no, and like act like I can't do that, I get tired, I get worn down because I'm like, I have to suppress who I am. But I'm like, there's a time and place to stim, just like there's a time and place to kiss your wife. You don't kiss your wife in front of your boss at a family function, but when you get home, you can kiss her. And then that's the huge thing that I've learned how not to mess, like knowing when I can do certain things and when I can't, and also being proud of who I am, because like masking is actually a disservice, because I was taught reading someone's face was more important than the way I actually understood people and listened to them. And the other way I mask is my body language, like I'm making eye contact, you know, how close I sit to somebody. And I have to constantly do measurements in my head. I'm sitting too close, I'm going to make them uncomfortable. Or how far should I sit? Like, these are all the thoughts people don't think about normally, but for an autistic person, we're thinking about it constantly. Like, oh my God, I'm touching my face too much. It's just this constant wave of consciousness. So I actually would say it's time to get rid of masking, because the idea of teaching them to act normal is like driving. Sure, there's rules to the road, but when you really think about how many people actually follow all the rules they were taught in driving school, not many. A lot of people drive over the speed limit. They, you know, they tailgate, you know, instead of following the proper length. And once I realized that normal people don't follow the rules that they like hammered into me in school that I have to follow or people won't like me, I was able to relax and not care so much about what people thought of me, because I'm like, okay, if they don't like me, and there's billions and billions of other people out there who have the potential to like me, so I'm going to focus on that. As long as I'm not hurting myself or anyone else, like I've done nothing wrong, and it's an opportunity to learn. And if we're going to get rid of the stigma around autism, we have to do away with masking. Because if you're telling us we're the mask, you're telling us that there's something wrong with us. Right? You wouldn't say that to a Hispanic person or African American or Chinese. Like, you have to hide who you are, and you know, someone from the LGBTQ community, you have to hide who you are because people will freak out. Like, no, we wouldn't. The ideal, we shouldn't do that. It's
right.
And I think masking is the same thing.
Well, Sam, how can our listeners find you?
Listeners can find me at Huber Family Event. Ventures on Instagram. You can find me at Sammy Huber on YouTube, Sammy Huber on Facebook. The best place is Instagram. That's where I'm most active these days.
Okay.
And anyone who's listening, you have questions about what you heard me say today, ask. I am an open book about dating, sexuality, any topic. It's like I said at the start of this interview, if we're going to end the stigma around autism, we have to talk about every topic. And we have to, if we're going to break through these social barriers, we have to talk about it. We have to advocate. So come ask me whatever you want and we'll have a conversation about it. And I'm open to helping anyone that's out there that needs like this kind of perspective.
That's great. Do you have any words of wisdom for those adults who are late diagnosed and also trying to navigate adulting on the spectrum?
I say the number one, be kind to yourself. Just because you're late in the game does not make you any less autistic than me or someone who got diagnosed at two. Two, you made it this far. If you have a job, if you have a wife or a husband or whatever, you're succeeding. Also, just live your life. Like I said earlier, the Hawaiian time, you get there when you get there. You got diagnosed when you were meant to get diagnosed. And learn how autism affects you and then learn how to make that your superpower. Because, you know, prior to autism, you would have been called eccentric, quirky, but people still accepted you. That, you know, people like Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, the guy who invented Pokemon, John Lennon, all did amazing things. If you really look at a lot of your heroes, I'm sure a lot of them were actually on the spectrum, that we have done a lot of great things, whether we're diagnosed or not. So keep pursuing your life passion. Keep being you. Like that's the biggest thing. And learn from your experiences and never stop advocating for yourself. Because you're your biggest source of strength, the biggest source of love. No one knows you like you do and what you need. So, you know, start there. Start with loving yourself. It's the biggest key. Like, because if you don't love yourself, what you're going to do is mask and you're going to wear yourself out. You're going to burn yourself out constantly. But if you love yourself more consistently, you'll find the burnouts get fewer and fewer. And I've gotten to the point when I do burnout, I recognize what triggered the burnout and I take measures to make sure that that burnout never happens the same way again. And I'm okay if I burn out again, but it's another opportunity to learn. And any behaviors that are caused by your autism is an opportunity to learn. It's an opportunity to love myself. It's an opportunity to teach other people tolerance, acceptance, and new forms of love that they never knew they were possible of. And that is the power that autism gives every individual who has it. You know, the ability to discover new forms of love and acceptance. And that's a gift this world desperately needs, especially in a country that's divided, a world that's struggling through a pandemic. We need people to bring it together. Because most of the adventures that autistic people make, Facebook, iPhones, are about helping people connect. And how much do we need our phones during this pandemic? You can thank autistic people for that. We got humanity to the moon. So let's keep inventing, keep helping humanity move forward because we're kind. You're kind because you are autistic. God gave you such a gift to be kind. So be kind to yourself too.
It's well said, Sam.
Thank you.
Well, that concludes our podcast for today. Thank you, Sam, for sharing your story to help educate and empower us. We wish you and your family all the very best. Thanks everyone for joining us today. Stay well, and I will talk to you next time.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Thank
you for listening to the Autism Mom MD podcast. If you like what you heard, please tell a friend, spread the word, and leave a review on iTunes. For any questions, comments, or suggestions for topics you'd like to hear on the podcast, please join our Facebook group, Autism Mom MD, or visit us on the web at www.autismmommd.com.